As America's first national institution, the United States Army has helped shape the nation and its values on and off the battlefield for 2.5 centuries. How did the Army contribute to exploration and westward expansion? What role did the Army play in advancing medicine, technology, and engineering? And how has the Army transformed to meet new threats and sustain America in times of national emergencies and natural disasters? For answers to these questions and more Army history insights, stay tuned.
Welcome to the U.S. Army History and Heritage Podcast, the official podcast of the United States Army Center of Military History. The Center of Military History writes and publishes the Army's official history, manages the U.S. Army Museum Enterprise, and provides historical support throughout the U.S. Army.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the United States Army History and Heritage Podcast. I'm Lee Reynolds, the Strategic Communications Officer for the Center of Military History. In this episode, we're looking back across 250 years of American and Army history to discuss how the Army's centuries of service has helped shape our nation. In war, in peace, exploration, westward expansion, medical, engineering, and technical advances, the Army has helped shape our nation from its very beginning through today. And joining me for this discussion is the Executive Director for the Center of Military History, Dr. Charles R. Bowery, Jr. Welcome, Dr. Bowery.
Hello.
All right. So we'll talk a little bit about you and your background. And so Dr. Bowery has been the Executive Director of the U.S. Army Center of Military History for over 10 years. Previously, he served on active duty for 23 years as an Army Aviation Officer, commanding at all levels from platoon through battalion, and serving overseas in Korea, Germany, Iraq, and Afghanistan. He is a published author, speaker, and battlefield staff ride leader focusing on the American Civil War, and he taught military history at the United States Military Academy at West Point. So thanks, Dr. Bowery, for being here. And, you know, I think this is an interesting discussion where, as we're recording this, we are about to commemorate and celebrate America's 250th birthday. But, of course, we celebrated the Army's 250th a year ago. Just a reminder how the Army is actually a little bit more than a year older than the nation it serves. So just looking back over the last 250 years, as we get into this discussion, can you identify or talk about some of the core themes within the Army that best represent its continued success and contributions to America?
I mean, as you noted, the Army is, of course, older than the nation itself. And the U.S. Army is really the first major institution in the nation's experience. And so the colonies, you know, you go through this process of breaking away from Great Britain, and then they form, they operate under the Articles of Confederation, then the Constitution. And so there's an evolution from this group of colonies into a group of really sort of semi-autonomous states that agree to this compact called the Articles of Confederation. And then under the Constitution, we form a national government that has national organizations and institutions, and the military is the first and foremost among these, and the Army is the only one of these that has been in continuous existence from, you know, bridging the gap from the Revolution through the Confederation into the new nation. You know, the U.S. Navy, for example, is disestablished for a few years after the Revolution. It comes back into being pretty quickly, but there is a break there where the Army is serving continuously, and it's the nation's key and foremost national institution in this early national period. And the two themes, well, I would say three themes that strike me that are important to understand about the Army's place in the nation's development are, first and foremost, this concept of civilian control of the military. You know, it's interesting that the Constitution provides for the maintenance of a Navy, but it calls for, and so those words are not an accident in the Constitution. The Navy was thought of as a, you know, which is ironic to my first statement, because the Navy was thought of as a standing institution that was necessary for national survival and commerce, where an army was thought of as an institution that was raised for a specific purpose, for a specific sort of emergency. And the Continental Army that becomes the U.S. Army shrinks to a minuscule size, just one regiment plus a few additional troops of artillery and some engineers right after the revolution, because there was a deep mistrust of standing armies in the 18th century world. And so, you know, that was one of the reasons that the founding fathers gave for breaking away from Great Britain and expressing their grievances about the British monarchy, was that they quartered troops in their homes, that they raised armies without their consent. And so standing armies were thought of as a tool of monarchical subjugation, not as a preservation of freedom. And so there was absolutely a desire to write into the Constitution the idea of civilian control of the military, that the elected government would manage the U.S. Army. And that happened in two ways. One, in describing the president's role as the commander-in-chief of the army, which again tells you a lot about the original intent for the armed forces, was that they would not be standing in peacetime, that they would be raised for an emergency or a conflict, and the president would serve as the commander-in-chief. A civilian official, elected official, would serve as the commander-in-chief. But then that the Congress has the authority to raise money for the support of these armies and to declare war. And so civilian control of the military is, to me, is the core principle at the heart of the Army's formation, because this leads to a professional ethic that is acculturated, inculcated in the Army and definitely in the officer corps, that they serve the nation's elected leadership, its political leadership. And the second theme that is important to realize as emerging from this era is the total force, what I call the total force nature of the Army, and that it's a combination of a regular force and citizen soldiers. And this, you know, has roots, first of all, in this distrust, as I described, of standing armies, that regular army officers are viewed as instruments of the state and instruments of an authoritarian government, not as being responsive to the motivations of democracy. So the original vision for this military that comes out of the Confederation period, and then in the early national period, once the Constitution is signed, it really makes the military at the center of the debate in the nation's forming between these two initial political parties that grow up. You know, the Federalist Party believes in a strong central government, a national bank, and a professional military. It's not an accident that one of the early advocates and leaders of the Federalist Party is Alexander Hamilton, who really had designs on being the Army's commanding general, and really advocated for a professional standing army on the European model that had trained regular officers and soldiers. In contrast to that, the other political party that grows in this period, the so-called Democratic Republicans, and really Thomas Jefferson is the kind of the chief standard bearer of this in the early period, is of the belief that the best military force for national defense that would be the least harmful to democracy would be a militia-based force. So basically, this political bloc in America believes, you know, these are competing understandings of how the revolution was actually won as a war, you know, and that the Federalists and these people believe in standing armies saw the Continental Army under George Washington as the force that decided the war, because they stood up to the British and they defeated them in open combat. By contrast, Democratic Republicans really believe that the citizen soldier and the raising of militia units and the mass outpouring of defense from the fireside by citizen soldiers, you know, was the element that resulted in victory over the British, because they exhausted the British Empire. And so these people would look back to Lexington and Concord, for example, or Bennington, as a place where these militia forces rise up and they use this unique American capability to fight on the frontier and to fight in what they called an Indian style or a Native American style to defeat the British. So there's a real debate about a regular army versus a citizen force, and the eventual structure that we settle on over the course of 250 years has been this total force. And so we never engage in any conflict now without all of these three components of the military: the regular army or the active army, the National Guard, and the Army Reserve. And then so I think the last of these themes that grows out of this period is the recognition, not that you can have one or the other, the regular army or the citizen army, but that both of these armies require a level of professionalism and training and education in the profession of arms that can only be done through dedicated training and schooling and a collective corporate mentality of professionalism. So I think when I look back on this 250-year period of journey to the present, I think those are the main themes that speak to me in the development of the U.S. Army.
You've hit on that professionalism a few times, and that's something that I think the Continental Army really needed, and that we saw really emerge during that first winter at Valley Forge with von Steuben and the creation of the Blue Book.
Right, and it was the idea of taking people who, you know, were obviously very committed to the cause because they endured these conditions, but you also introduced in the character of von Steuben the other major fact of our history as a nation and as an army is this dependence on our allies and our partners. And so, of course, you had people like von Steuben who came and trained. You had Lafayette, Rochambeau, de Grasse, these French army and navy leaders who led forces, who advocated for the partnership of France and the new United States, who provided material support in terms of supplies. They brought French expeditionary forces and fleets that provided a critical capability. They led, in many cases, French officers led American soldiers in combat. And we think about Yorktown at Redoubt Number 9. And then the Spanish, Bernardo Galvez, you know, the consul in chief or the chief Spanish royal official in North America who governed Spanish Florida led a separate army of his own that tied down the British in the Gulf states, in the Gulf region throughout the war, and was also critical to our victory. And so we haven't done any of this without our allies and partners, but all in the pursuit of this professional ethic.
Right. And then moving forward, or actually still looking back a little bit. So when we do talk about how the Army shaped America, we really have to go back to that, to the Revolutionary War, because without the Army, there is no United States of America. So can you talk just a little bit about what was the Army's essential role in winning the war and establishing the United States?
Well, yeah, I mean, it, at the heart of it, this was a war. This was a military conflict between a group of rebellious colonies and the world's largest military and imperial power, Great Britain, at the time. And so the idea that this group of colonies could band together and defeat Great Britain was incomprehensible, you know, certainly at the start. And so the critical role of what becomes the U.S. Army cannot be underestimated in this. And it's really, it's a product of the service and sacrifice of all of these men and many women who supported and joined the Continental Army, served. They served in militia units that supported it. But it was all at the, in the service of really, as I see it, you know, one essential man, and that was George Washington. And so we, of course, celebrate George Washington as our first president. He established so many of the precedents and the ideas and the ideals of the nation as a whole, but he began that journey as the commanding general of the Continental Army. And so, you know, he was first and foremost a military commander who was able to understand the strengths and limitations of his force. He was able to understand the motivations of the citizen soldiers and the people of the different colonies and states. He was able to band them together in a common purpose. He was able to identify talent in leaders who he made his subordinate commanders. He was able to enforce discipline and standards. He was able to communicate with the Congress. So he really established this core principle that is essential to a democratic nation with an army, is that the role of these senior generals is to communicate the Army's needs and activities to its political leadership, and not to freeze them out or to exclude them, but to involve them. And so Washington had an incredibly sophisticated perception of that civil-military relationship that has established that as the core principle of our military. And the and one of the greatest examples of this, in a moment that really preserved the revolution and set us on this course of proper civil military relations, is told in a great exhibit in our National Army Museum. And it's in a theater in the Army and Society Gallery, and it talks about the Newburgh Conspiracy. And so, this was an event that happened, after Yorktown. So this is early 1782. The Army is encamped around Newburgh, New York, as they are waiting for things to play out in the peace negotiations and the rest of the conflict. And it becomes clear that that Congress, there are elements in Congress that are not willing to stand up in Congress and advocate for the pay of the Army, and in particular, the officers. And so the officers have gone without pay for quite a long period of time. And there's a growing group of them who are advocating what amounts to an insurrection. And they're going to advocate in banding together and going to Congress to lobby for their pay. And what this would be is a mutiny. And this is a very dangerous time that could potentially throw away all of the achievements of all these people over all of these years of the revolution. And so George Washington learns of this. There's supposed to be a meeting called of the officers to discuss it. For whatever reason, that meeting doesn't happen, but George Washington learns of it and he calls his own meeting and he brings the officers together in a building there at the encampment at New Windsor, New York. And he talks to them about what this insurrection would mean for this conflict and how it would throw away all they had achieved. And at the end of it, he believes he's failed to motivate them to stop, and they're silent and they're looking at him. And there's this iconic moment where he takes out his spectacles and he puts them on to read a letter that he'd received from a member of Congress about this. And he looks up and he tells them that, you know, not only has he, is he grown poor and old in the service of his country, he's given his fortune, he's served for no pay, he's older, he's frail in health, but he's also gone blind. You know, as he put, and this was an unscripted moment, as near as anyone can tell. And the effect that had on the group, you know, was to just, it was seismic. And they just, they looked at themselves and there were audible gasps in the room at the thought of this. And this, this, this controversy melted away. And they went on toward, toward settlement and victory and reunion. So, it's, so I don't think we can, I don't think we can overestimate the Army's importance in so many different ways to the successful conclusion of this, this past independence.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, so beyond the revolution, as America developed and expanded in the first several decades after the war, the Army played a significant role. I mean, you know, we say that you couldn't have established the United States without the Army, but I don't think we could have expanded without the Army either. So in those first few decades, three or four decades after the revolution, can you talk a little bit about the Army's role and how impactful it, it was and the contributions it made in the expansion of our nation?
And this is a story that, that has a lot of complex and complicated and difficult and hard moments in our past. But the Army plays a central role in the creation of the United States as we know it, and the primary vehicle for that that development, of course, is westward expansion, and it's the bringing into the nation's fold of all of these states, you know, west of the Appalachian Mountains, really, in the years after the Revolution, and the Army plays a critical role in this process all the way from initial exploration to settlement to management to the development of the infrastructure of a modern nation in terms of roads, rivers, communications, settlement patterns. All of these things are really generated and driven by the U.S. Army. And so this begins at the very beginning. So when we think about the westward expansion of the United States, of course, that begins with exploration, and American exploration begins with the Lewis and Clark expedition. So the Lewis and Clark expedition to the West Coast is led by Army officers. It's an Army expedition. The Corps of Discovery is largely composed of officers and soldiers. And so that's the only place in the new nation where you're going to find individuals with training in navigation, in survival, in movement over long distances, in water movement, in maintaining supplies and fortifications. And when it comes right down to it, in defending themselves in armed combat, in many cases. And so the Lewis and Clark expedition begins to map out the nation. Based on these maps, you have the westward movement of settlement. And throughout this process of settlement of the West, the Army is there. And they form, they build posts, they build forts that that both provide protection and logistical support to westward expansion to citizens and civilians. But they engage, well, they engage in conflict with Native American tribes, which again is a really difficult part of our past. They also engage in things like military support to Native American removal in the Trail of Tears. And so these are elements that we have to reckon with as we understand the Army's role in westward expansion. But the bottom line is that none of this expansion occurs without the infrastructure, the expertise, and the resources that the Army brings in the West. And so many of the places that we think of as the earliest settlement points in westward expansion are formed around Army installations. St. Louis, Missouri, on the Mississippi River, of course. There's an early Army installation there. Jefferson Barracks is formed in St. Louis. And so that's a jumping off point for military forces in westward expansion. Then you move steadily westward, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, Fort Huachuca, Arizona. All and many, many places in between are these Army posts that support westward expansion.
And I was going to say, you think of things like Pike's Peak. You know, we had the Pike Expedition, Army-led expedition also. Vermont, Department of Alaska. I mean, there's so many of these things that helped to open up America. And the Army's role was what I think it was called a constabulary force, basically to protect and to guide the exploration and then later on the settlers.
Absolutely. And this chain of Army posts that go across the Western United States were the way stations that supported westward expansion, and they allowed it to happen. And so you have, because as we develop communications methods like the telegraph, the telegraph will be key in the Army's development of this communications infrastructure to support its posts, will in turn support the development of settled areas in the West as this expansion occurs.
Right. So we have the expansion, but then once we expand, we need to build up the infrastructure. So a tremendous amount of technological support was needed to do this. So can you talk about how the Army contributed to that? How the Army was at the forefront of providing support in advances in technology, engineering, and medicine?
And here I go back again, this idea that in the new nation, the Army is the source for trained people in these professions. And so, the Army Corps of Engineers is one of those items that we in 21st century America just take for granted. I mean, we see it all around us in the impact of the Army Corps of Engineers without really realizing it. But this Corps of Engineers, and it's so called because the earliest, as I talked about, the earliest professional soldiers in America are engineers and artillerists, because those were the branches in the 18th century that had professionally trained people who had school, scientific, and technological training. And so that early, the Army's oldest post at West Point, New York, is originally home to its school for engineers and artillerists. And from this grows this Corps of Engineers that will provide much of the engineering expertise that lays out and maps the growing nation through the 19th century. And so Army engineers are the ones who lay out roads. You know, they survey them, they lay them out. They in many cases, they build fortifications and posts that are the nucleus of urban areas that grow up around them. They design them. They map and they survey rivers. They build bridges. They survey and map out harbors. When we talk about the Corps of Engineers, and within the Corps of Engineers, there's even an elite of the elite. And this elite within the elite of the Corps of Engineers are called the Corps of Topographical Engineers. And so the topos, as they were called, are these individuals. These are truly the most expert people in the Army. And so in the 19th century, when you graduated in the top of your class from the military academy and went into the regular Army, you were commissioned as an engineer primarily. And so the most highly performing and advanced Army officers in the 19th century really up to and through the Civil War are engineers. And these topographical engineers, they map and they lay out the new nation. Topographical engineers like George Meade are responsible for designing and building lighthouses, for example, up and down the Atlantic and the Gulf Coast, on the Pacific Coast, and in the Great Lakes. So they design and build lighthouses. They survey harbors. They develop canals. All of the infrastructure of America is done by the Army Corps of Engineers. When you go out to Rock Island Arsenal in Illinois, you know, which is at the confluence of the Mississippi River and the Rock River, on the border between Illinois and Iowa, the oldest metal railroad bridge in the United States is the so-called military bridge over the Mississippi River, and it's constructed by the Army. And so that bridge enabled rail traffic across the Mississippi River in the early 19th century. And so all of this infrastructure and this movement and this growth of the new nation is a product of this engineering expertise. And the second area you described in medical terms, the other area where the Army provides so much expertise to the new nation is in terms of doctors and their medical expertise. And a great example of that, of course, is Dr. Walter Reed, who was born in 1851 in Virginia, but he was an Army physician. And so, you know, he was one of the individuals who confirmed the theory of the transmission of yellow fever by mosquitoes rather than direct contact. And so his work, you know, founded the fields of epidemiology and biomedicine. He was essential to the successful completion of the Panama Canal. In many ways, he exemplifies how the Army Medical Corps created medical expertise in the new United States.
So they contributed not just for military purposes, but for the medical profession itself.
Absolutely.
And beyond Walter Reed, there are others, and you know I think the Army helped find vaccines like for typhoid. And what is that? Yellow fever we talked about, but so many others, and even up to through modern day, you know, with the Army's response to the COVID.
That's right. I mean, when I think back to our recent history, there are moments when the Army is critical in things like disaster response and supporting civil authorities in responding to bad things that happen. All the way back to my early time as an Army officer, I was in my basic course in 1992, in the fall of 1992, when my in-laws and my wife were living, she was back home with her parents in Miami, Florida, during Hurricane Andrew. And so one of their memories of Hurricane Andrew was the arrival of the 82nd Airborne Division to support and to provide disaster response in South Florida after Hurricane Andrew. Then we fast forward to 2005 and Hurricane Katrina, the incredible work of the Army National Guard in New Orleans and the Gulf to respond to that. And then on a national scale during COVID, the Army's medical expertise, Project Warp Speed to develop quick vaccines was a project that was led by the Army Materiel Command. And so even up to the 21st century, the Army's medical and technological expertise has been a critical part of our national health.
Yeah, and in continuing to talk about the disaster relief, I mean, it's not just this century or the last century. It goes back, well into the early 1800s as well. And, you know, a lot of people have heard of the Johnstown flood, the San Francisco earthquake and fire.
Right.
But it was the Army that responded.
That's right.
To these and made a difference in that. And even with modern the fires that you're seeing,
yeah, too. I mean, there are so many ways that that the Army has touched parts of the nation that, again, that we see as part of our landscape. And, you know, and one of the most compelling of those to me is our national park system and the Army's critical role in safeguarding the national parks at their outset in the early or in the late 19th century. So, you know, you had the establishment of the initial parks such as Yellowstone out west, but by the late 19th century, these places had fallen into disrepair. They were subject to a lot of government corruption and mismanagement of public lands. There were you know, significant swaths of the parks were being grazed. They were being clear cut for logging and lumber, and so you had a really dire situation for these national spaces, and the Department of the Interior was really failing to maintain these public lands. And so who does the government turn to? They turn to the Army. And so for a period of about 30 years, you know, until the end of World War I, the U.S. Army is responsible for land management in our national parks. And so in 1886, soldiers from Company M, the 1st U.S. Cavalry at Fort Custer, Montana, traveled to Yellowstone, and they began a 32-year presence in Yellowstone National Park. For a two-year period, much of the force that provided this land management was composed of the Buffalo soldiers. And so the 9th and 10th U.S. Cavalry, the African-American regular army units, provided much of the park management force for a period of several years in the late 1880s.
Yeah, and by doing this, the Army really put itself out there, and they were the go-to resource for the Interior Department to use, because not only Yellowstone, but you had Yosemite, Sequoia National Park. So the Army was really playing that role as the administrator for all of these parks.
And then even after, you know, after World War I, another great example of how the Army made a direct impact on the daily life of the nation was in the development of transcontinental transport and roadways. And this was modeled by the Army's transcontinental motor convoys. And so, you know, one of the key technological advances that armies used to move around the battlefield in World War I was the truck. And so the Army had developed these so-called Liberty trucks. Again, one of them, which you can see in the Army and Society Gallery and at the National Museum. But these Liberty trucks demonstrated long-range transport of people and supplies. And as the nation expanded in the early 20th century, it became really essential that we develop a better interstate highway system. And so in order to demonstrate the need to maintain, to have federal maintenance of roads, both for military purposes, but also for civil use, the Army arranged to conduct a transcontinental truck convoy. And this truck convoy drove 3,000 miles. They departed from Washington, D.C. on July 7th, 1919, and they arrived in Oakland, California, on September 6th. They had 24 officers, 15 observers from the War Department, including a really famous young officer who'd become much more famous later on, Brevet Lieutenant Colonel Dwight D. Eisenhower, was one of the observers of the convoy, and 258 enlisted men. And so they drove their convoy across the nation, but this was a moment of national awareness of the Army as they traveled through these areas across the country, but they also highlighted the need to maintain paved roads because the convoy, as they moved across the country, they broke and had to repair 88 different wooden bridges. And practically all of the roadways over which they traveled from Illinois to Nevada were unpaved. And so this causes the trucks to break down, so they had to stop and fix them. But all of this highlighted to Congress and to the nation the need to maintain infrastructure.
Take that to the next step. Once we're in the Depression, we have the Civilian Conservation Corps, who created to do a lot of these public works projects. But the Army played a key role, I think, in training and supporting this as well.
Yeah, they sure did. And so the Civilian Conservation Corps was one of Roosevelt's New Deal programs to get people to work. But it took a military organizational construct and it applied it to these large labor projects, which were designed really for the improvement of local areas, but for beautification, for construction. And so they took infrastructure projects that needed doing around the country, and they assigned people who signed up to work in these CCC units. They assigned them to Army officers, and until the mobilization began for World War II, this was really a primary role of the Army in the early years of the Depression, was to manage these CCC camps and units around the country. And they did a lot of work for the nation during that time.
Yeah, and as I talked about, how the Army has helped shape America, this is just another one of those great examples of literally shaping the country. I want to talk a little bit also about some of the other technological advancements that the Army has been at the forefront of, computers, rocketry, things like that. Can you address some of those things?
Sure. I mean, in the areas of sort of communications and technology, particularly from World War II on, the Army has been a critical generator and creator and user of the technologies that these are things that are a part of our daily lives and environment that we take for granted, but that the Army really developed. And the first of these in the immediate aftermath of World War II is the rocket technology that drives the space program. It drives the development of satellites and communication satellites. And so the rocket program is an Army program. And we go back to places today like White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico, which were Army projects at Redstone Arsenal in Alabama, Huntsville. This was an Army installation, still is today. But all of these were projects driven by the Army, and the technology that we used for the rocket program has infused practically every other aspect of our modern lives. The development of computer technology, particularly in the areas like navigation, like GPS, the sea change that occurred in the way we did everything was evident in Army technology. When I became an Army aviation officer in 1993, the way I navigated in a helicopter was with a map and a pencil. Within 2 or 3 years, as I joined the Army, in my first advanced aircraft, the Apache A model helicopter, it had a Doppler navigation system. So, we think about Doppler radar and its uses in weather forecasting. Well, we use Doppler radar in the early version of the Apache for navigation. And so that moves on to, in the immediate aftermath of Desert Storm, we begin to develop GPS technology, global positioning system, which uses satellite navigation. And so all of these capabilities were first developed, envisioned, and proved by the Army. The key technological development in our life in the 21st century now, being robotics and being artificial intelligence, are being used and developed by the Army today in real time. And those things, again, started in the early 90s after Desert Storm.
One of these big themes that, through everything that we've been talking about is how the Army adapts and transforms to meet the current challenges and to predict the challenges in the future. So can you talk a little bit about that as we start to wrap up here? How does the Army use the lessons of America's first 250 years to move forward and to inform the current decision makers?
In my daily life in the Army, every leader I encounter is inherently historically minded. They are constantly asking themselves and they're asking people around them for context. And they're seeking to use not just descriptive lessons from the past, i.e., we did this thing 100 years ago, so we're going to follow that recipe or action plan to solve a challenge now. But they have a habit, and they have a habit of mind of looking back to the past. But the other lesson I draw from that is the very symbiotic relationship the nation has with the Army that continues to inform every aspect of our lives. And so I believe that the free interplay of the Army and a democratic society that is driven by the idea of civilian control is the thing that allows us, it allows the nation to continue to benefit from the Army's development. So the Army is constantly, the Army isn't solving problems with technology in order to just provide direct benefit always to the nation. They're doing it to solve mission problems and to solve operational problems. But there is just an inherent idea that it's just accepted as natural that we will take technologies that the Army has developed or ideas, and we will use them for the benefit of American society. It's just a given. And so I think that's the real power of that relationship.
Before we wrap it up here, we've got our segment called Huzzah Trivia. So before we close, is there some piece of trivia that you have to share about how the Army has helped shape America?
Yeah, and I'm just going to give a direct example of something that to me is really meaningful, you know, as we get ready to celebrate the 4th of July, 2026, and the 250th anniversary of the nation. You know, we talked about the formative role and the central role that one person, George Washington, played in the development of our nation. And so the early national fathers, and particularly after the death of George Washington, quickly decided that the nation's new capital in Washington City needed a monument to George Washington. And so the work begins very early on. Robert Mills, an architect, designs a Washington monument, which is supposed to be this incredibly grandiose 555-foot marble obelisk. You know, so you think about a 500-foot-tall object, and clearly the monument that developed isn't that tall, but they developed this idea of having a marble obelisk with a pantheon structure around it. That took place. The work began, but then stopped during the Civil War. But then after the Civil War in 1876, the project began again because Congress directed the restart of the Washington Monument project. So at the time, the only part of the monument that existed was really the bottom half, so the base of the Washington Monument that we see now. But at the restart of the project in 1876, who do they turn to rebuild the Washington Monument? They turn to the Army Corps of Engineers. And so a young Army engineer named Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Casey was the lead engineer in charge who took over the stalled project. And so what Casey did was to redesign the foundation because he was worried about it falling down. And he redesigned the foundation to provide a poured concrete foundation for the entire structure so that it would support the weight of this massive obelisk and not fall over. And then he basically made it a more streamlined and simple design, really in cooperation with what we see today, which is this very simple but very striking obelisk on the Mall. But that is the project that is the product of a team of Army engineers. So Colonel Casey was assisted by Captain George W. Davis, who managed the daily logistics of the site. And then the civilian military engineer, Bernard Green, who also was sort of the structural engineer of the project. So my trivia today is that when you look at the Washington Monument, you should see the Army.
And what's interesting, too, is that when you do look at it, it's two different colors. So the lower part that was built before the Civil War is one color, and then it's a slightly different color for the rest of it. And I think it's because of different quarries that they used for the stones.
That's right.
But great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bowery, for your insights today about how the Army has helped shape America. And if you'd like to learn more about Army history, I encourage you to explore our website at history.army.mil. And if you want to experience Army history every day, then visit our social media sites on Facebook and Instagram. So thanks for joining us today on the United States Army History and Heritage Podcast. For the Center of Military History, I'm Lee Reynolds. And until next time, we're history.
The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or opinions of the U.S. Army or Department of Defense. For more information about the Army's proud history and heritage, go to history.army.mil.